Hello and welcome. This is Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review, where we highlight legal issues, prominent lawyers, and obscure blue book rules. We are your hosts, Adri Langemeyer and Robert Cunningham. A special thanks to our sponsor, Gibson Dunn, a premier full-service international law firm with nearly 1,400 lawyers and 20 offices. Gibson Dunn recognizes that a law firm is, at its heart, a collection of individual attorneys, so they strive to hire the highest quality law students and attorneys, professionally and personally, and grant them the autonomy in shaping their own career path. Gibson Dunn attorneys bring a unique, diverse perspective to the firm's community, and the firm values a culture of respect and professionalism that promotes a dialogue with room for all viewpoints. Visit www.gibsondunn.com to learn more about Gibson Dunn's Summer Associate Program and hiring opportunities. Today we speak with Hillary Holmes. Hillary is a partner in the Houston office of Gibson Dunn & Crutcher and co-chair of the firm's Capital Markets Practice Group. Her professional expertise has been widely recognized, and she has received Band 1 rankings for capital markets by Chambers USA for the past 5 years, as well as awards from Texas Super Lawyers, the Association of Women Attorneys, and many more. Hillary is an incredibly thoughtful businesswoman and has been intentional in developing her professional brand. We discuss how having a working mother had a positive impact on her career, how she developed mentor relationships, and what it looks like to create your own opportunities as a woman in the legal field. Good morning, Hillary. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yes, we're so grateful that you had the time to speak with us today. So, so excited to talk to you. We're going to start with just some background information. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
Sure. I was born in Houston at Women's Hospital, and I grew up in Houston until I went away to college. And I'm actually a fourth-generation Houstonian on my father's side. And so had my great-grandparents around when I was growing up and my grandparents very involved. My mother was from New Jersey, so I spent part of my summers, every summer growing up, up in South Jersey on the near Ocean City, near Atlantic City at the beach. And it was a lot of fun to have so many generations around me when I was growing up.
Yeah, that's really unique, I feel like, and especially to have such a long family line from Houston. That's kind of a cool legacy to have when you're, you know, a native Texan and Houstonian. Was there anything else about your upbringing that maybe influenced or impacted your career path?
Yes. So my mother was a lawyer, or still a lawyer technically. And so I grew up watching. She was a public finance lawyer, a bond lawyer at Vinson Elkins. And so I grew up watching her do transactional work, which is what I do, and really enjoy it. I saw her passion for her work and how much she threw herself into it. So it was not uncommon for me to be, you know, walking around the house on a Saturday, and my mother was at the dining room table with papers spread out everywhere and, you know, on the landline. I mean, you know, we're talking the 80s here.
Right.
You know, and then often she would disappear to the printer, which meant she would be gone. You know, I wouldn't see her for 4 or 5 days, you know, and back then when they had to do everything on paper. And then I spent a lot of time running around the halls of what was then called First City Tower. I think I got in trouble once for drawing on the wall of the ladies' bathroom at V&E as a little kid. And her partners were, you know, like aunts and uncles to me. And, you know, one, I remember a couple of them, you know, threw me a graduation party when I graduated from high school at their home. You know, it was a very tight-knit group. And so I just saw a lot of positive energy there in terms of her experience and how much she loved her work and you know, helping people and doing exciting transactions, or transactions be considered exciting. And just, you know, I thought, well, I want to do something like that. I want to do something that has me, you know, wanting to work on a Saturday and excited, you know, to go into the office and be with nice people and all of that. So, you know, I don't think I knew exactly what that meant, but certainly, you know, having a mother, watching my mother in that role, very confident had an influence on how I thought about my career path.
Absolutely. And I feel like that is, a bit unique to have such a powerful woman as your mother, as a role model, seeing her, especially in that day and age, working full time, working on Saturdays, being in a law firm, being a partner in a law firm in Texas, that probably would have been maybe a bit unusual at that time. Was that something that made you feel like you stood out at all compared to your friends, or was it just the norm for you?
Yes. Well, two things about that. One is, it was unusual. So the sort of the neighborhood and the school I went to was, very homogenous environment. I recognize that. And probably a bit unfortunate, but at least I recognize it. And most of my friends, at least mothers, did not, work for pay. Obviously they worked as mothers and such, but, we didn't have jobs like that. So it was kind of interesting sometimes, and I'll be open about it. Struggling sometimes to defend, feeling like I had to defend her, or, it'd be harder for her to volunteer at the school or things like this. But looking back on it, on balance, her being such a strong person and doing something that she loved that contributed to our family's well-being was much more important than her, making, that choice is just as valid. And for me was, very, contributed very well to the course I decided to take with my life. So I'm very proud of her and, respectful of her choice there. And I think that the other thing I'd say about her, it's interesting with the upbringing point, is she was her and her brother were the first people in their family to go to college. And then she went on to get a master's and a PhD and was a professor for a while. And then my father moved her back to Houston. He too had a PhD, and they met in academia. So he moved her back to Houston, where he was from. Mm-hmm. And she tried to get a job in the local universities as a professor. And the way she explains it to me is she suddenly realized that no women were getting tenure at those universities. So she ended up getting a job at Vincent Elkins as what then didn't have a name, but what became the legal assistant program.
Okay.
And she developed the legal assistant program there, like created it, by looking for people who had been in academics, particularly women, but there were some men too, and telling them, look, the path in academia is limited for women. Come here and you can research and you can write and you can be intellectually stimulated, and have a sort of a better career path and probably higher compensation.
Yeah.
So she built that program for several years in the 70s. And then eventually, some of the partners that she worked with said to her, you should just go to law school. Like, I don't know why you're just not a lawyer. So I had already been born at that point, and she enrolled in University of Houston and went to law school, had my sister while she was in law school. And then I actually got to stand with her when she was sworn into the bar. I don't remember it, but there's a picture. That's pretty cool.
That's
a little girl
really awesome.
A grown woman's hand as she's sworn into the bar. And then she stood with me when I was sworn into the bar. So I think just knowing beyond the having a career point, knowing that she was someone who was adaptive mm-hmm. to the situation, and looked for and wasn't afraid to take advantage of opportunity, even if it would be hard to go to law school while working and with a baby and then another baby and all that, just persevering through that. And, really is something that I aspire to do, definitely influential in my career.
Absolutely. Well, two things to say that. One, your mom sounds like a very interesting person who has a lot of fun stories to share. So we might have to get her on the podcast one of these days. The other is I can absolutely see where you get your drive from and the same adaptability that your mom has. I have definitely seen in your career as well. So it sounds like she, you know, taught you some very valuable or inspired some very valuable skills in you as well. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. So you left Houston after growing up here. You went to Duke University and got your BA in public policy and women's studies and history. At that time, obviously you grew up with your mom being a lawyer. Did you know that you wanted to go to law school?
I didn't know for sure. I knew that might be something that I would do. I was more focused on the policy side. Mm-hmm. So I was I spent several summers in high school the high school I went to had a sort of a winter term where you could go away and do, you know, take internships and such. Mm-hmm. It's a really neat program. And all of those winter terms, I did something policy oriented. So I spent a lot of time in DC. Okay. So I thought I wanted to go into the policy side of government. I wasn't sure exactly what that meant. I'd worked for a presidential campaign. I'd worked for a senator and then I'd worked in one of the administrative branches. Mm. So, you know, sort of tried different aspects of governmental service. And that's one of the reasons I majored in public policy studies and chose Duke for its Stanford School of Public Policy. Mm-hmm. But so law, you know, going to law school would kind of make sense if you wanted to go into policy. But by the time I graduated from college, I had spent more time in DC and come to the conclusion that I did not actually want to be involved in the federal government or politics, that both of them were a bit broken. It seemed a bit frustrating to me, especially when I worked on one of the presidential campaigns. Mm-hmm. I got an absolute insider's view. I was actually brought on staff from being a volunteer partway through my time there and sort of saw how the sausage is made and didn't like it. So law school seemed like a good idea. Yeah. So I did decide to go to law school. I also, in college, got exposed through public policy studies, sort of more of the economics, mm-hmm. What was there called economics classes, but, you know, at some universities, it'd be like a business class or something like this, and really found myself drawn to that and drawn to the theory of markets and capitalism and how does it all work and mm-hmm. sort of what keeps our economy spinning, and thought, well, I want to be part of that, mm-hmm. not necessarily on the business side, but somehow support that. And so then that led to law would be a good way to be supportive of two things. One would be intellectually stimulated. I never wanted some kind of routine punch the clock type job, or else it's just not worth doing in my mind. So I thought, well, okay, this will be intellectually stimulating. It'll keep me close to the policy side mm-hmm. of things because I'm going into a field that requires an understanding of regulations and interpretation of the law, mm-hmm. and that requires an understanding of the policy reason behind the various rules we're helping our clients comply with. And then second, if I go into the transactional side of law, which at the time I didn't know exactly what it would be, but I can be sort of in the business side of things, mm-hmm. but, you know, from a legal perspective. And so by the time I finished university, I knew that, you know, I was going to go to law school and I was going to go be a transactional lawyer of some sort. And actually my first summer in law school, I clerked at three law firms because back then you could do that. Mm-hmm. And one of them I selected because at the time I was still sort of leaning towards this public policy side of things. And so one of the law firms I picked because it had a Houston office, but it also had a DC office that has a big lobbying group and public policy practice. And so I wanted to keep kind of my options open at that stage. But by the time I got to my second summer, after I had tried my hand at different practice areas as a summer associate, I knew, okay, no, really transactional work is going to be, you know, the M&A, the capital markets, that kind of stuff.
Well, it sounds like you had the benefit of being able to get a lot of different kinds of experiences early on that really helped to influence your future path in the law. And one of the things I was also hearing is that kind of getting that experience in public policy and also some of the business and economics background that you had during college helped inform you about what a transactional practice might look like, which is, you know, unusual for a lot of first year law students that hear transactional work for the first time and are like, so you write contracts and don't really understand yeah. all the pieces that go into that. So it's interesting to hear how you kind of got those pieces before ever going to law school. So you ended up going to law school at University of Pennsylvania's Carey School of Law. When you got there, was law school what you expected it to be? Was it harder, or what was the biggest challenge for you?
Yes, so law school was not exactly what I expected it to be. And the first semester, I will admit to you, was a big challenge for me. So I had finished college a little early, and so I had worked for, and then I took a deferred my acceptance for a time. And so I actually worked as a consultant for a nonprofit and traveled around North America and such. And so I had some distance between, a little bit of distance mm-hmm. between college and law school. So that was helpful. And, you know, I mean, I know most of your audience is already in law school, but to the extent anybody's not there yet, I mean, I encourage a break between college and law mm-hmm. school for sure. but so when I got there, I guess I saw a stark difference between people who had gone straight from college to law school and who hadn't. I thought it would be a little more serious than it was. It was a little more closer to college than I expected. That was one thing that was different than I expected. The second thing that I had a hard time adjusting to, but eventually got the hang of, was just how on your own you are in law school, and how, you know, sort of intense it was going to be in terms of, you know, all of the reading and, you know, outlining and, you know, being ready for the Socratic method and, you know, the different styles of the different professors. I mean, I had professors that just were at opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of their teaching style. You know, were they all theoretical all semester and then the exam was, you know, very matter of fact, you know, that threw me off sometimes, things like that. So, I think that, you know, my first semester, I'll admit to you, was it was probably my worst semester in my academic career. And, I mean, it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't what I was used to. And that was very hard to deal with. But the key to getting past any challenge is just pick yourself up, dust off, figure out what you did wrong and fix it. So I spent my winter break that first year, you know, really thinking about what had I done wrong? What did I need to do differently? Just honest conversation and specific planning. And to do that, I actually called up several people I knew who were in grades above me, classes above me, to ask who I knew were doing really well and such. And, you know, ask, okay, well, how do you study? How do you prepare for exams? And just tried to learn from others' experiences, because I saw no reason that I had to just figure this out completely on my own, which I think is how I felt my first semester. I didn't know anybody when I went to Penn. I didn't know a single soul, and I lived alone in an apartment. I mean, I made friends, and it was great and all that, but it was pretty isolated, and I didn't have really anybody mentoring me or anything. So I wish I had, looking back, you know, taken more initiative in terms of seeking advice from those who had already gone through this experience, particularly at the same school. So I did that, and then everything went great from there on out. So we were all set. I also, the other thing I learned, which frankly I knew from college, but for some reason thought I should do things differently in law school, which is, you know, just, I don't know, that doesn't make sense. I learned that, you know, I have a certain way, or I recognize that I have a certain way that I learn and a certain way that I study most effectively. I'm a visual learner. I pretty much like to do it on my own. versus study groups and everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got to law school and everybody's talking about these study groups and oh, we got to share outlines and all of this. And I never did anything like that in college and did great. So why would I change the formula?
Mm-hmm.
But I did. And I think that's another thing that, you know, when I went to law school, I got swept up in was, oh, it's law school. I must do it the way,
right.
you know, I hear about it in the
yeah.
movies and the way everybody else is doing it, as opposed to sticking with what I know works for me.
Right.
And so that was a hard, but a good lesson. Good
yeah.
lesson. Because it carries through to your career too. You know, when I'm preparing for a presentation to a board of directors or, you know, analyzing an issue, like I know how it works for me to do that work,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I should do it that way and stick to it.
Yeah. Well, I feel like there were so many great just little pieces of advice in there, especially for 1Ls that are, you know, getting to their first end of the semester and preparing for finals. But some of the things I was hearing you say was, you know, talk to those above you, talk to those with experience, but take it with a grain of salt and trust that you know you best also. And, you know, I was very much the same way as you discussed, in what I study best alone, and sometimes will supplement with group work. But it's a thing when you get to law school and there's suddenly all these buzzwords and things people are talking about that you need to do. And it is easy to get swept up in that rush of like, this is how I should be doing things. But at the end of the day, it sounds like you know yourself best and you know how you succeed best and to trust in that.
Yes, absolutely. You got to, you know, U of H, fantastic law school. You did something right getting there, you know, stick with it.
Right. So jumping forward, post-law school, your first job out of law school was at Baker Botts. And you were there for quite a long time, which we're going to talk about. But what type of work were you doing when you started there at Baker Botts?
Sure. So I went to Baker Botts to work in the corporate department, as it was called. And so lawyers in that department at the time did everything from capital markets work, you know, like think IPOs and bond offerings and things like that, or, you know, M&A. So, you know, merging two companies together or buying or selling some assets, that kind of thing. And then just regular corporate counseling in terms of governance or, you know, if you're a public company, getting your reports filed correctly with the SEC, things like that. So it was, I touched all of those areas. It's a very, at the time it was a, an open system and you could do whatever work kind of landed on your desk or you sought out. At the time in 2003, it was very busy. There was a little bit of a residual sort of post.com year 2000 work going on. So there's a lot of like formation of little companies mm-hmm. and sort of capitalizing them with some venture capital. There was a little bit of that, but by my second year, that was pretty much gone. And what I spent most of my time on was capital markets transactions in the oil and gas industry. And primarily at Baker Botts, that was related to master limited partnerships, or they're just publicly traded limited partnerships, which was a very popular tax-advantaged vehicle at the time for going public if you had a certain type of business in the oil and gas industry. The classic examples, like a long-haul pipeline, you know, that moves mm-hmm. crude or gas across the country. So those businesses that were involved in that type of structure are very capital intensive businesses. So they need capital constantly, and they also pay dividends. Well, back then they paid dividends to the public called distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So they constantly needed new financing. So that keeps capital markets lawyers busy because you needed to be, they needed to go to the capital markets often to get cash to fund mm-hmm. their business. So, I mean, we were just cranking out those deals constantly. I would have multiple offerings in a week.
Oh, wow.
Definitely multiple offerings in a month. And back then the work was a little more labor intensive because the securities laws were different at the time. Mm-hmm. For one, which I don't need to go into, but it created a bit more work for the lawyers. And then second, we did more things in person. So for even just a routine, what's called a follow-on offering, which would be an already publicly traded company selling additional equity or mm-hmm. debt to the public, which is you know, once you've done it once, doing it a second time and a third time and a tenth time is really just, as we called it, you know, dupe and revise of the documents. And so, but we would still, even in those situations, meet at the printer to work together on the documents. And we'd be there for a couple days until, you know, as the baby associate, definitely I'd be there till 3 or 4 in the morning, always the last to leave. It was really intense, and we were doing that a lot. And so that's what I was spending my time doing. And the reason I give you all that detail was because that volume of work was a really excellent training opportunity for me. I was very fortunate to come out of law school at a time where a firm like that was that busy. And there were that many opportunities for work that a junior associate is critical to and very involved with. You know, there's some type of work where as a young associate, you're just not going to get exposed to very much, or at least not down in the trenches that much. That's a lot of what's going on right now. But back then it was, you know, it was mostly, you know, the junior associate and the senior associate kind of doing the deal, and the partner would kind of check in and make sure nothing was broken. and so you got a lot of reps, you got a lot of training, and you got a lot of face-to-face time with the clients, whether they be the investment bankers or the company that was issuing the securities, with the lawyers on the other side. I formed a lot of friendships in those rooms at 3 in the morning with my fellow junior associate, who is now my, you know, fellow partner at another law firm, and we still enjoy working together, kind of a thing. It was a really special time. It was grueling, but it was great.
I love I love your perspective on those early years, because you do hear a lot of, you know, just how challenging it is and how exhausting it can be. And I love that perspective of just like getting in there, hitting the ground running and rolling your sleeves up and getting to learn in an intensive environment early on. And it sounds like that opportunity, you know, really paid dividends for your career in getting to see that kind of breadth of work at an early stage.
Yes. And there's 3 things I'd say about that. One is seeing a breadth of work is important, because while we talked earlier about, oh, well, having, you know, studying economics in college and whatever else, you know, may inform where you think your legal career is going to go, what area of practice you want to focus on or eventually specialize in, is true, it's not sufficient to make an informed decision. So I encourage young lawyers to try out as many different opportunities as they can possibly find, and see what just clicks with you in your gut. So for me, when I would do the capital markets work, I mean, it was like, it's like people who are really good at learning foreign languages, and they just like pick it up instantly. It was just an area that I just picked up instantly and could, you know, by the time I was a third year, I could just run these deals. And I loved it. It was great. So, you know, look for the language that you can just pick up, or that, you know, maybe it's challenging for you to pick it up, but it gets your passion going. Cause you know, this is a, you know, especially for this type of work, you know, it's a lot of hours, it's hard work. So you have to enjoy it, or you are going to be miserable and you're probably not going to stick around. And then the second thing I'd say that complements that is young lawyers should be assertive in looking for work. So view the business development skills that eventually you're expected to develop in some cases, depending on your career path, are ones that you can start developing the day you start at your new law firm out of law school, because you can start learning how to market yourself to the associates more senior to you and to the partners, depending on the type of law firm you're at. You know, you can start to think about how you can leverage experience to get more experience and so forth. So, you know, don't sit in your office and wait for, or sit in your home office maybe, and wait for the phone to ring. Like, get out there. And I know that's harder when we're all working remotely, but, and for this class that's about to start, these classes, these first year classes that are about to start at law firms here in the shutdown. Yeah. We're putting in a lot of procedures to make sure that they are fully integrated from day one, like day morning calls every single morning with all of them on video, you know, checking in, that kind of stuff. And we'll, you know, be staffing them on all the deals right away. You know, so if you're somebody who just graduated and you're getting ready to start, you know, make sure that you talk to your law firm about, okay, what's the best way for me to get integrated? We're not all going to be sitting down the hall from each other physically. And so I think those are important things to remember, not just as a young lawyer, but, you know, even as a senior associate or a partner.
Absolutely. And I think that's one thing I've probably discovered during quarantine is that people are, one, a lot more accessible than you realize, and two, a lot more willing to have a conversation, have 15 minutes for coffee, if it's even if it's by Zoom or by phone. And it really just takes that initiative to reach out and not be afraid, be respectful, but not be afraid to ask for that time. So I think that's all great advice. So you were at Baker Botts for nearly 15 years. And, you know, these days it seems so much more uncommon for a young lawyer to stay at their first firm for that amount of time. And I'm curious just on your perspective on really growing up with a firm, you know, from first year associate to partner, and kind of the benefits of that and your experience with that.
Yeah. Well, it worked really well for me. I enjoyed it very much. I had a lot of support. I had several mentors that were, you know, very generous with their time with me and with, you know, helping me navigate everything from, you know, client interactions, tough legal issues, things like that. But also, as you grow up in the law firm, you know, how to navigate how the firm works and how to best position yourself for whatever your goal might be. There were a couple points in my career where I thought I'd rather not work at a law firm and just work at a, and not just, but work at a corporation. Mm. So go in-house, as they say, just to try to get some, you know, more regular hours or, you know, look for opportunities to sort of dabble in the business side, because I do see in-house lawyers, depending on the company and their structure, sometimes they are more involved on the business side of things. You know, they're in the room with the CFO and things like this, making business decisions. And I thought, well, that would be really fun. So there were actually two points when I was an associate, and one had to do with when I had my first child. Mm. And I think a lot of new mothers go through this, and new fathers too, where they think, gosh, I would really like to know that I'm working from 8 to 6 and, and sort of have that certainty. You know, I did get a couple in-house offers but I was at a place where I trusted my mentors so much and really valued their advice and knew they would be honest with me and not selfish. And I went to them in both times and said, okay, I've been given this offer. What do you think I should do? Like, what do you think is best for me? You know, and they gave me honest advice that was just so helpful. And I'm so grateful that they encouraged me to stay at the law firm, because for me, and it's just me, that is the right setting. So I was at a very, I enjoyed growing up there because it was a very, you know, sort of a family kind of place. And like I said, I had these mentors that were incredible. I think that, you know, it's funny you say it's less common for young lawyers to stay at their first firm. And that is, you know, a newer development in Houston. So when I graduated law school, there were, you know, there were like 3-4 law firms that did the kind of work I wanted to do. You know, and so I, you know, picked from among them. Mm-hmm. Now there are so many options in various practice areas, you know, including litigation. I mean, they're just the number of law firms has just multiplied that have, you know, offices in Houston. So it's wonderful, wonderful for the law students to have so many different options, because so many of these firms are so different from each other in terms of culture or in terms of client base or area of focus and practice area. So it's great because now you have all these options to find what works best for you. And that's mutually beneficial for both the law firm and the new lawyer. Mm-hmm. So that's great. It's also good for the clients. I mean, as much as I'd love to have a monopoly on all legal work in Houston, competition is healthy. Competition is good. Competition means that we, you know, up our game and do, I mean, we were already doing the best job for the client, but I mean, I'm just saying to the extent right. anybody rests on their laurels, they can't do that anymore. They have to, you know, earn the work every day. And that's good for the clients, which is good for us as a profession.
Yeah. I love what you were saying or sharing just about your mentors along that path, even through, you know, a changing market in the legal market and a changing personal life. It sounds like you really found people that you could be very frank with, even within your mm-hmm. law firm, being able to talk about, hey, I got this other job offer, to me is like a very scary thing when, you know, you don't want to upset anybody inside your firm. How was it that you came about those relationships? Did you seek them out? Did they happen kind of naturally? How did you find those mentors?
Yeah, that is always a good question. And one, it's challenging to find your mentors, and you cannot just assume that it will happen overnight. It's just like a close friendship. Mm-hmm. It ultimately should be a close friendship in my view. And you have to, you know, be patient and put work into it, just mm-hmm. like you do with a friendship. So I would just think about it. I wouldn't be overwhelmed by the concept of, oh, I've got to find a mentor, you know, and mm-hmm. it's this like really ominous thing. I would just think about it like, I'm just going to get to know everyone in, you know, however you define it, in my practice group, mm-hmm. in my, you know, whatever. And I'm just going to, you know, start to get to know them and start conversations with them. And you can be very deliberate about it in terms of, I mean, I had lists of people. I was like, okay, I'm going to, by the time this month or quarter or whatever it is over, I'm going to have gone to lunch with these 10 people. Mm-hmm. And when I go to lunch, we're not just going to talk about the weather. We're going to talk about, you know, how they got where they are, what lessons they've learned, you know, to the extent they're willing to share.
Right.
But not a hardcore intense interview or something. You know, you should also talk about the weather, or the Astros, or whatever it is that interests you. But, you know, just getting to know each other, but also making clear, you know, I've asked them to lunch because I think they have something to teach me or something I may learn from. And that can be as simple as just asking about their background and other things that people enjoy talking about. And then you can sort of take it from there and just see if a natural mentor or even sponsor type relationship develops. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it came about for me. I mean, the ones who there's one person in particular who is still to this day my mentor, and we talk every week and we get together, and I ask his advice on things. And that came about, because I mean, I was working on a lot of his deals. And so we were just spending a lot of time together, mm-hmm. and we found that we had a mutual enjoyment of struggling with, you know, intense securities laws issues, mm-hmm. which probably sounds really nerdy, but we enjoyed nerding out together. We also had a similar view of, you know, certain other things in terms of, you know, how you work with clients, sort of style, things like that. Mm-hmm. But you know, there were also things that, you know, he does a certain way that I was like, you know what, I have my own style with respect to that issue or sort of the way to approach certain things.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not that you have to sort of imitate your mentor, but it's just an opportunity. It's a safe space to have an open conversation about, you know, questions you have or things you're struggling with, or, mm-hmm. or just, you know, an opportunity to learn from someone else who's sort of plowed this ground already.
Yeah.
So most of the mentors came from people I had worked with a lot. And then I ended up sort of hanging out in their office. You know, after we finished the conference call, it's like, okay, now I'm going to hang out in your office for a while and talk some more and that kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. And with the remote situation, I would just encourage people to, you know, like you said before, be respectful, but reach out and ask for opportunities to get together, mm-hmm. Outside of the substantive stuff, or, you know, hey, you know, we just finished that conference call. You know, I'm working from my house, you're working from your house. Can we hop on the phone at whatever time is convenient for you, so I can ask you why you handled the client that way, or mm-hmm. why you answered this question that way, you know, learn the why, okay. behind the behavior you're observing. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's great advice. So after you left BakerBots in 2017, you moved to Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher to start their Houston office. And you're now partner there and also co-chair of the capital markets group. How did that opportunity come about, and what did it look like to think through making that big leap?
Yes. So that was a big leap. That's a big moment in my life, and one I'm so excited about. I mean, it's just energizing to do something that bold. And it's turned out to be an incredible success, so that helps too. it came about just because, I mean, there were, like I alluded to before, you know, lots of law firms that are not headquartered in Texas have opened offices in Houston over the last, it's pretty much 10 to 12 years. Mm-hmm. And many of them had approached me about, you know, joining their office that was already here or helping start a new office. And so, you know, those conversations probably went on for 4 years or so. And I was very happy where I was, mm-hmm. and doing great. And as a, you know, I made partner in January 1, 2012. And so once I had made partner, I just wanted to focus on building my brand, building my relationship, sort of being able to stand on my own two feet as, mm-hmm. as a partner. That's my experience was that once I was a partner, I was kind of on my own a bit. So I needed very different than being an associate. So I was like, well, I'm going to seize on this opportunity and not be scared by it and just leverage the relationships that I've developed as an associate to turn them into partner level relationships and go find new business and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed doing that. It's daunting and it's a bit scary, right? But it is really fun if you think about it as an opportunity to just talk to people about something you love doing and how you can do it really well for them and make them a success. Like, who doesn't want to talk about that? So I focused on that for the first few years, but these other firms had called during that time. But I was like, I just need, you know, it's to move seemed like a bad idea to me. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I got to a point where I thought, you know what, I'm ready for a new challenge and I'm ready for sort of a non-Texas based platform, frankly, and you know, a firm that's a little more diversified. So I was super happy at BakerBots. It's an incredible firm, top notch. But just for me, was ready to try something different. Yeah. And so there were several opportunities I had. This was, Gibson was the one that in my gut felt like worth doing. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the one where I made the most money. It wasn't the one that was the surest thing, like having a big office already, right. in Houston. It was, you know, but it was a leap of faith a bit, but I was confident that we could do it. And part of the reason I was confident that we could be a success was we built a team that I really believed in.
Okay.
So when I opened the office, we had 8 founding partners. Mm-hmm. 7 of us were very close, had all worked together before, some for decades. You know, I trusted these people. I knew their families. I mean, like, this was the team I would put before a client any day of the week, mm-hmm. and be 100% confident that the client would be extremely pleased. And also, we just all like working together. Like,
yeah.
We enjoy hanging out 20 hours a day together, you know? And that's, you know, I mean, we've taken trips as a group together, just not because the firm financed it or something, just like, we're all like, let's grab our spouses and go to Vegas or whatever. And so we did that and saw Elton John and whatever. So, so it's a fun group. So if you like the people you work with and you believe in them, I mean, that's that's like 80% of being happy in your job, mm-hmm. you know, finding the practice area you love and finding the people you want to be around.
Yeah.
So that's why this one sounded like the right one for me. I also like the idea of starting something new, mm-hmm. like a new office, but with, you know, a top five firm behind me. I mean, that seemed really exciting. And it really, I sort of surprised myself in making that decision and finding that to be the one that was the most compelling. It's turned out to be fun every day since.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I pick up on as a theme throughout your life and career is just the importance of not only your actual family, but building family-like relationships. And that was true when you were at Baker Botts. And it sounds like starting the Gibson office in Houston really gave you that opportunity to build another little family in the Gibson office here. And, you know, kind of like you were saying, that is so important to have those people behind you and working with you, and it just makes the work so much more enjoyable. So I think that's really awesome that you were able to carry that on and take on such a big risk and have it be such a great success. And kind of jumping off of that, you know, in an interview that I saw online with you, you were talking about challenges that you faced, and you gave this response, and I want to talk about it a little bit, but I'll read it for our listeners. You said, "Opening some doors that are just not open to women in my industry was a challenge that you faced. I found that they're often unlocked, but you have to have the courage to turn the knob and walk in with confidence. I also found it is sometimes best to create my own doors." You know, and this Gibson opportunity really sounds like one of those challenges, but also a possible unlocked door. Did you find that it was one of those situations, or was this a door that you created for yourself?
It was a door I created for myself. And there were one of my partners who I'm very close with, another woman, we, you know, did this together, and we were so proud to have our, you know, picture of the founding partners have two women in it, particularly, and, you know, with our focus on the oil and gas industry and being mm-hmm. transactional lawyers. I was sitting with the general counsel of a company I do bond offerings for just on Friday at lunch, and she was saying, gosh, how many female capital markets lawyers are there in Houston at this point? And it was, we couldn't even fill up one hand. So I think that this opportunity was one where, you know, I felt that I could really stand up on my own two feet and really mm-hmm. define how I was perceived and how my team would be perceived in the marketplace, without any kind of legacy perceptions, of a firm that had been around for a while. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely a new door that was created. Gibson is the most collegial group of incredibly intelligent people I've ever met in my life. And so having all of them as my partners, as that broader family, mm-hmm. has also created lots of opportunity for me to, you know, go through that door and build something really successful on the other side and sort of define how it looks without regard to gender and such, just on merits. And that's very refreshing. It's definitely something that I wish was not still an issue, mm-hmm. sort of the gender divide or the bias or the language I hear sometimes where you presuppose that it's a man on the other end of the line, right. You know, things like this. But I don't worry about that too much. I never have, because I just know that if we just give it another 10 or 20 years and we really put our mind to it, we'll get closer to parity. But right. I think it's just going to be lopsided for the rest of at least my career. And so I intend to, you know, support other women so that they can walk through doors that they want to and do it with confidence, even if they have to fake that confidence for a period of time, which I certainly did. Now I just walk through with the confidence because I certainly have earned the right to have it. But also that they feel that they don't have to just work within the confines of whatever institutions exist now or whatever construct is now. They should, you know, speak up and be their own person.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a wonderful encouragement for all of our listeners and not just the women out there. And I can absolutely say that I'm grateful for women like you that are creating new doors all the time and leaving those doors open for people to follow behind you. So when I Googled you, Hillary, a lot of articles popped up, and it's clear that you have a presence and a brand online. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what it means for an attorney to build their professional brand? And you spoke about this a little bit earlier on, but can you give us a little more, I guess, depth to that, what it looks like to build that professional brand as a young attorney or any stage, really?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it takes a lot of discipline, in my view, and a lot of persistence. So, you know, I think that developing for me and for what my practice area, and it would probably differ for litigators and some other practice areas. But for me, what I try to put out into the public realm is a very, you know, professional branding that is consistent with me and my style. So again, being true to yourself, because my style is not for everyone, just like any lawyer's style is not for everyone, but it works really well for the clients who enjoy working with me and I enjoy working with. So I try to have the public presence, sort of the publications you put out there and the speeches and everything, be consistent with that at all times. So for example, I try to look for opportunities to speak on issues I care a lot about and I think need to be discussed in the public realm, and try to look for substantive opportunities. So there, for example, there are more conferences and, you know, whatever, now it's webinars and things on diversity issues than you could count. A lot of them are just, you know, sort of money-making operations and, you know, every law firm in the country sponsors it, you know, just because they feel like they have to because the other law firms are sponsoring it or whatever. And if that kind of opportunity comes up, it's not very appealing to me. If an opportunity that is more about going to have really substantive discussions on diversity issues comes up and really give me a platform to express my opinion and engage in, you know, tough conversation, then, you know, I'll take it. But that's one example on issues I care about. And then on the substantive side, I try to look for opportunities to give presentations with really reputable organizations that, you know, again, are very substantive. So, you know, there's some regular conferences that give briefings on updates in the securities laws that are, you know, 3 hours long, and I'll do those presentations twice a year. And that really helps establish me as an authority on the topic, and as but also if you're speaking, you know, makes you gives people a chance to see your style and know that you're accessible, and so forth. Then there's also opportunities through writing. So the writing can take the form of, you know, just publications that are articles, and looking for ways to get them published in other media forums rather than just through your own law firm. And that goes a long way. I try to look for opportunities to not just publish the client alerts. And we have a securities regulation blog. It's called the Securities Regulation and Corporate Governance Monitor. If you just Google Securities Regulation Monitor, you'll find it. You can subscribe to it. And that's an easy place for us to publish quick updates on what's going on in governance or securities regulation or shareholder activism and such. But outside of the law firm publications, I try to look for opportunities to either write articles that will be picked up by business-oriented magazines, sort of industry publications, you know, speak with Wall Street Journal reporters. I was on the phone with NPR last week, sort of things like that, that have a broader non-legal audience.
Right.
And try to explain something that's happening in the legal landscape or something that's happening in the capital markets. Like, why are there so many SPAC IPOs? Is a common question right at this moment. And, you know, talking about that and explaining sort of the legal nuances behind it, but in a way that you know, the layperson would care about it,
right?
Or the investor would care about it. So that's helpful with branding because it just gets your name and your authority out mm-hmm. beyond just the legal field and the legal audience.
Yeah.
And then repurposing all of that through other social media
platforms.
Methods is helpful in mm-hmm. terms of, yeah, platforms, social media platforms, which is, you know, newer to me. Obviously, I didn't grow up as an associate. There were no social media platforms. There wasn't, you know, even apps until 2009 or whatever it was. So you know, this, but I think, you know, I try to stay very disciplined on, you know, I'll share, like, on LinkedIn, I post a lot of content, mm-hmm. but I am very disciplined about what I post. Mm-hmm. Like, I will see other people comment on other articles and things that other people post. And I try not to do that because I'm trying to keep my stream very substantive mm-hmm. and helpful to the reader.
Yeah.
And instead, if I see somebody who says, you know, I've been promoted to whatever position on LinkedIn, I'll send them a personal note mm-hmm. rather than just hitting the congrats button on LinkedIn.
Okay.
And I think that's even more effective as a side note.
Yeah.
But as a young lawyer, I would just encourage you to seek out whatever opportunities you can within the firm to help with writing client alerts, you know, setting up a blog if you don't have one yet, you know, offering to be that person who, you know, spearheads the effort for a blog on whatever topic is your practice area. Also, I love it when associates come to me and say, hey, did you see this development? Here, I've written up a alert on it or a blog post on it. Like, they just take the initiative to do it. That is always welcome. And we will push that content out quickly. And you know, they are listed as an author. So then they start showing up more and more as an authority on that topic. And that just begets more opportunities. So mm-hmm. the more you do it, the more you'll get. But I think, you know, just figuring out what you want to kind of be known for. I mean, as a young lawyer, it's really just helping out on anything to kind of get your name out there.
Yeah.
But then as you start to focus on a certain practice area or certain topics are of particular interest to you, like I'm spending a ton of time on ESG right now and writing about it, speaking about it to non-legal groups, things like that. You know, if you can find a topic you can, like, really dig into,
right,
be an authority on, even at the expense of not being an authority in some other areas, that's fine. Like, okay. Just own that and get known for it.
Yeah.
And then be consistent in your message.
Yeah. Well, and that was all such great advice. And if I was to boil it down to a couple of takeaways, what I was hearing you say was to be disciplined, be consistent, be curious, and be authentic in pursuing and developing your personal brand as an attorney. And those four things will kind of push you in the direction that you need to be moving in to establish yourself in the industry. So thank you for sharing all of that advice. And we are, I see, about out of time. And so I just have one final question for you that we ask of all of our participants, which is, are you pro Oxford comma or not? And why?
I am pro when there's more than three things in the list. I just think it's the most consistent way to present a list. What are you?
I am also pro Oxford comma, but I will say before law school, I was not. And it took some very intensive discussions, I will say, with my fellow Law Review members to get me there. But I see the benefits now and the consistency. So I have been converted to a pro Oxford comma gal.
Nice. Good.
Well, Hillary, thank you so much for your time again and just for sharing your story and your career with us. It was really wonderful, and I can't wait to share it with our listeners.
Well, thank you so much. And I feel like someone should interview you at some point on some of these questions, because I feel like you have a lot to teach us. You've obviously established an incredible presence and been extremely successful already. So, I think that you should be interviewed sometime soon.
Well, thank you very
thank you
much
for taking the time. This is wonderful.
Thanks for listening. Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. Production is possible because of generous support from the Houston Law Review Alumni Association. If you have thoughts on today's episode or suggestions for a future episode, email us at emphasisadded@houstonlawreview.org. Follow the Houston Law Review on Twitter and Instagram at Houston L. Rev, or find us on Facebook under the name Houston Law Review.